on Saturday, July 2nd at 7:30 p.m. The Indianapolis Jazz Orchestra presents a USO-style patriotic celebration in honor of Independence Day. Ticket information at 356-9063 or online at thevirginia.org.
The funds that are in the bank by June 30th will be used to maintain the WILL radio program services for the next 12 months. Every dollar makes a difference now because of the continuing decline in our federal, state, and university funding. We must not only meet, but also exceed our listener support goal this year, and you can help. You can mail a check today to the Friends of WILL Radio. We're at 300 North Goodwin in Urbana, Illinois. The zip code is 61801, and we thank you very much. Good morning and welcome to Focus 580. It's our morning talk program. My name is David Inge. Glad to have you with us. This summer, we decided that we would like to devote a number of programs to the subject of energy, energy policy, and to looking at the question, how is it that in the future we will meet our needs for energy? And among the programs we decided we wanted to do, we said we wanted to do some shows looking at nuclear energy, that is using nuclear plants to generate electricity, and whether or not that we should expand that. Right now it provides something like 20% of the electricity here in the United States, and there are certainly both proponents and opponents. And in this hour of the program, we'll be talking with someone who clearly is a proponent of nuclear energy and has been for a long time. His name is Barclay Jones, and he is professor of nuclear plasma and radiological engineering at the University of Illinois. As we talk, questions, as always, are welcome. The number here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. We do also have a toll-free line. That's good anywhere that you can hear us. 800-222-9455. So at any point, questions are welcome. Also, by the way, if people are interested in, as we continue to look for different things to talk about that touch on energy policy. Maybe if you have an idea for a future program, a topic, a guest, you can let us know. You can drop us a line, call us, send us an email. We're certainly happy to have whatever suggestions and ideas that you have. Well, thanks very much for being here.
I'm happy to be here.
We appreciate it. As I said, the Bush administration has said that they definitely believe that we should be dealing with our dependence on imported energy sources, and they have put together an energy policy, and we have talked about it in various ways, and I'm sure we will continue to. One of the things that the administration has said is that we should expand nuclear generation. Not that that'll do anything about our demand for imported oil. That's perhaps a separate issue. But if we're concerned about pollution that comes from burning fossil fuels, particularly coal, some people will argue that the only way that we really can meet the need for energy and deal with the problem of global warming is by using nuclear power. How much more do you think of our energy needs above the 20% now do you think we should be thinking about for nuclear?
Well, I think in the long run, it can and should play a larger role. The current 20% has remained steady since the 70s. Hmm. And the only way it's done that is improved operation. Well, we're running out of, you can't do better than 100%. And the capacity factors are very high now. They're in the 90s, including shutdowns for refueling. And as a result, that number will probably change since our demand for electricity continues to grow. Not rapidly, but steadily.
And it is true that other countries get a much larger portion of their energy needs met by nuclear power than we do, certainly much more than 20%. There are some countries that are up in the 70s percent.
Yes.
And also places that perhaps have not built a new plant in a long time, countries where they are now thinking about starting to break ground and build new plants.
Well, we're thinking about doing that here, but clearly Japan does not have the general resources that we do. They basically import virtually all of it. Nuclear is attractive to them. They have a large percentage. France in the 70s got really bit by the oil embargo and said never again. Mm-hmm. And they went wholeheartedly into a full nuclear production program for electricity. And they produce 70%+ of theirs. And have for quite a while, have continued to build to keep that percentage. We will have to do something similar to maintain the percentage. Mm-hmm. But it's pretty clear that the current energy policy is moving toward, the proposed policy is moving toward where nuclear would become, would grow. Mm. There would become new plants. And there are three or four consortia at the moment who have made discussions with the Nuclear Regulatory Commission, their oversight group, that they are planning to come forward with a licensing request for new power plants.
When you ask the question, why is it that it has been now such a long time since ground has been broken for a new plant, people will give you different sorts of reasons. They will say it's because of the cost of building the plant. It's because of the burdens of the regulations they have to follow. It is because of the fact that perhaps for a long time we didn't really need it. And then, of course, there's the issue of public concerns and perhaps resistance to having a nuclear plant located somewhere near them. Is the answer to that question, why has it been such a long time since we've started a new plant, all of those things, or does one of them particularly stand out?
I think all of them are a factor. The one that stands out most, I think, is the uncertainty related to licensing. Mm-hmm. In the past, it was a two-step process where you got a license, got a site approved, and then had to get an operating license after it was built. The way we allow companies to recover their costs is after they are in production. So the cost of the plant, in many cases, ran over 2, 3, as many as 4 times, $4 billion for Clinton Power Plant. That makes it non-profitable to build. So with that uncertainty, which should cost in the neighborhood of $1,000 to $1,200 per kilowatt installed, which means a Clinton plant should cost a little over $1 billion. If you can't count on that, then you're likely not to move forward. Mm-hmm. And that's what's happened. Now we've moved it to the point where the licensing will be done in one, as one operation prior to building. And as long as the plant's built according to what was approved, it will have an operating license. So that takes away the uncertainty and Wall Street's likely then to get in line to provide funding for building.
How does the cost per kilowatt hour of nuclear generation compare with other things, coal, burning natural gas, renewables?
It's a little hard on the renewables to get a real hard figure. It's a small percentage. I'm not sure it's developed well enough to get a good number. But the on coal, it depends what sort of cleanliness you have to build into the coal plant. If you have to build in the reduction in emissions, then their costs will run up similarly to the nuclear side. Mm-hmm. Coal costs are a little higher than uranium costs. Natural gas is cheaper to install significantly, much more expensive to operate. Natural gas is expensive. And from my point of view, I abhor the idea of using that precious resource to make electricity when we have viable, good other ways to do it. That's such a useful product in the chemical industry, in plastics, all of these industries. Mm-hmm. Though the oil and natural gas are really precious commodities.
Our guest in this hour of Focus 580 is Barclay Jones. He's professor of nuclear plasma and radiological engineering at University of Illinois. We're talking about nuclear energy, and questions are welcome. 333-9455, toll free 800-222-9455. I think that surveys have shown that if you go out and ask people what what are their concerns about nuclear power? The thing that turns out to be the leading concern is not what you might expect. It's not the concern that there might be an accident at your local nuclear plant, although that does indeed concern people. The chief concern seems to be waste disposal. The nuclear power plants produce a very highly radioactive waste that's got to be contained for a long time. The United States has been involved in now in a project to locate a storage site in Nevada. But there continue to be problems with the site, and I think that there are some people who doubt whether it ever will operate. It may not. And in the meantime, the nuclear plants are storing their high-level waste on site. And I'm sure they're getting to the point where they're tired of it, it's costing them money, they're running out of space, and they're saying to the government, look, you promised that we would have, that you would have a site operating. So it's a significant problem. What do we do about that?
Well, I think there are a couple of ways to do it. We need to move forward with Yucca Mountain. It's not the be-all and end-all answer, though. We have enough to virtually fill it now. And so if we move them all, we just create a new problem of refilling the sites. Mm-hmm. And refilling the sites, you might say, well, our plants will only last a certain period of time. We're now getting extensions of 20 years to those licenses, which will add another tens of percent to the waste stream. We need to reprocess. I think there's no other way to properly and probably legitimately handle that waste. Some of it is so long-lived that if we put it all together, we then have to arrange storage for these very, very long times. Hmm. You hear 10,000 years and so on. We've never built anything in man's efforts to last that long. Pyramids last a long time, but this is a little different. So what we need to do is separate out the various components in this waste stream. Some of them die quickly, so they sort of go away. Others have 30-year half-lives, and these are a couple of the larger fractions of the fission products. You realize that when a fission process occurs, you take one atom, a large one, uranium, and split it into two. So we get two byproducts, most of which are radioactive, decay at different rates, half-lives of short times, years, tens of years, hundreds of years, and the 10K. The real answer here is to get the very long-lived ones extracted, americium, some of these, not large quantities, but last basically forever. Mm-hmm. And some of the shorter-lived ones that we might be able to engineer, such as strontium and cesium, they're the largest percentage, 30-year half-lives. So if we kept it for 10 half-lives, 300 years, we could probably engineer that.
So that as a, you're saying that as a storage issue, we ought to be able to think about being able to store that safely for 300 years. That's a kind of a figure you think
yes.
you can wrap your mind
yeah.
around and say, technically, that's a reasonable amount of time that says, okay, we can think about a storage site that's going to be safe and intact and good for 300 years.
And
how much of a percentage of the waste do you think would fall into a category like that?
I didn't bring the exact figure, but it's
you can be a ball
certainly player. Yeah. Tens of percent.
Okay.
Tens of percent of the waste. Now, part of the other, the actinides, these higher long-lived ones, there is also plutonium. And we don't burn all of the uranium. We burn very little of it, as a matter of fact. So we've got all the uranium left. We have some uranium-235, which is the fissile, the fissioning part of the isotope bunch. And as a result, we can reuse that. And so if we separate those properly and put them into streams, watch proliferation, those issues, then we could cut this requirement down for Yucca Mountain to be reasonable. As a matter of fact, Argonne is looking at reprocessing, and they see the capability of one Yucca Mountain taking care of all the nuclear plants that we have now and then some, if we can redirect appropriately streams away from this and only keep the very long-lived ones and put them in Yucca Mountain.
Just to make sure that I'm clear and the people who are listening are clear, when you're talking about reprocessing, you're talking about taking nuclear material and doing something to it so that then you can take that and use it again to generate, again in the same sort of way, to generate more electricity.
Parts of it. Some of it is just waste, clearly. The fission products are basically waste. Maybe some of them can be used in other isotopic applications in medicine, this sort of thing. But basically, it's a waste stream. The natural uranium and the uranium-235 that we actually increase the percentage to operate light water reactors depletes that uranium-235 part. And so we still have uranium-235. Small, quite a bit smaller. And we have built up plutonium, not insignificant amounts of it, over a 4.5-year cycle. The fuel assemblies are used nominally for 4.5 years in a cycle, and then they would be waste. So if we extract there, we can take plutonium out. Perfectly good fissionable material.
But it's also something that you can use to make nuclear weapons with.
As we can with uranium-235. Mm-hmm. And that's where I think the proliferation issue becomes more manageable, because maybe it's sort of a backwards argument. Mm-hmm. But uranium-235 can be enriched quite readily now with centrifuge. You don't need large, very costly diffusion plants that most countries couldn't afford. Now you can do it with centrifuges.
And end up with something that you could make a nuclear weapon.
Absolutely.
If you wanted to.
Absolutely.
Well, do you think then, or maybe I'll ask the question this way, among those people who say we're really concerned about greater reliance on nuclear energy because it produces all this waste, and the thing that concerns us about the waste is that we're producing materials that might be used to make nuclear weapons. So do you think for a lot of the people who are concerned about expansion of nuclear power, the big thing that they're worried about is nuclear proliferation, the fact that we are ending up producing materials that could be used to make nuclear weapons?
It's certainly one of their staple arguments. My view of it is that that can be controlled. The material we get in a waste stream is highly radioactive. It's not the sort of thing where you take a used fuel assembly to your garage and do something with it. You'll die in the process. Mm-hmm. It's so radioactive. So you can leave it spiked with radioactivity as you go ahead and reprocess. And that, in a sense, provides security.
That is just, it's not going to be an easy thing to handle.
No. Mm-hmm. Very difficult.
If this process of taking used nuclear material, spent fuel or partially spent fuel, and then separating out these various components, taking out the material that's just waste that you can't do anything with, taking out that material where the half-life is relatively short, so it's going to be dangerous for maybe hundreds of years and not thousands of years, and taking that material that can be reused. How, technologically speaking or technically speaking, how difficult a challenge is that? Is that something that we today know how to do?
The separation process.
Right. Yeah.
We definitely know how to do it. The Europeans are doing it. The Japanese are doing it. We've known how to do it. We're learning how to do it with newer techniques that provide more efficient ways to do it. No, it is a known technology, and an improving technology. Hmm.
Do we end up with actually more fissile material at the end than at the beginning?
Very good question. Not in our current reactor types. These, if you refer to a growth of more than you started with, mm-hmm. of fissile material isotopes, you'd be dealing with a breeder.
Right.
Interesting. Sort of the animal type comparison. Our other reactors, the ones we're using now, are converters. So they convert, but not enough to replace. So it's less than that. Mm-hmm. And it's less in the point of 60% or so. The fast reactor does the breeding. Not in large percentages, but anywhere from 4 to 7% if you design it correctly. So you can make plutonium at the rate higher than your burning fissile material.
Mm-hmm.
That was the integral fast reactor that Argonne had ready to go and was canceled by the Department of Energy president, basically, at that time, and told to cease and desist.
And
we know how to do it.
Who was the president then? Was that President Carter?
No. It was President Clinton.
President Clinton.
Right at the beginning of his first office. Mm.
We have a couple of callers here. We'd like to bring them into the conversation. People are listening. Certainly, you're welcome to call in, ask questions, make comments. 333-9455, toll free, 800-222-9455. Our guest is Barclay Jones. He's professor of nuclear, plasma, and radiological engineering at University of Illinois. We have a couple of callers here. We'll start with someone in Champaign, line one. Hello. Scholar there, line one. Well, I think maybe they must have changed their mind. Let's go then to caller in Indiana. This is line number four. Hello.
Hello. I have a number of questions. First up front, I'm not particularly one way or the other about nuclear power. I think it's sad that we haven't used our coal resources and used the technology that's available to keep things clean, but things don't seem to be going that way. What concerns me more than anything is American industry. They do not have a good record for following regulations, in particular like to sneak things underneath the curtain, so to speak. So that's what concerns me. And since France is doing it and Japan's doing it and other countries, I presume they haven't had any serious accidents, at least I haven't seen anything in the papers on this side of the ocean. So I'm wondering just that problem right there, besides, you know, the usual people don't want it in our neighborhood or anything. There must be something that, that maybe over-regulation would set the policy or something like that. If you could speak to that, and then the whole problem about waste, you know, I've heard people talk about, well, we'll just put it in a rocket and shoot it out in space and hope that the damn thing doesn't fall back into the Earth. Something along those lines in terms of the safety relationship to other countries, their standards and regulations and versus ours, and often our industry doing things that they shouldn't be doing. Thanks.
All right. Well, you want to talk about those things?
Yes, I appreciate your bringing these up. It is a mystery, I think, to the public what sort of regulation and performance the industry has developed over the last few decades. We started this in the 1960s. Our operational experience was low then. We had experience in the Navy, and we're operating similar plants to what the Navy has. But in 1970 or so, the availability of plants to be producing 100% of their capacity was in the high 60s or about 70%. We're now above 90%. We've learned how to really operate these plants well, safely, and efficiently. So, but we're running out of that because we can't get above probably 95% would be the best we could ever expect, because we have to stop every year and a half for about 2 weeks to refuel about a third of the plant. Now, the reprocessing that you indicated or that other countries are using and I spoke about earlier, we've known how to do that for a very long time. And that has been improving and I think is very well handled. You spoke a little bit also about the, are we following rules and regulations? Yes, we are, as an industry. I served for the last 7 years on an Institute for Nuclear Power Operations group that examines the training programs of operators and maintenance people at nuclear power plants. It's a very stringent control, and sometimes the groups can't quite meet the bar, and they get sent back and brought back in again. Those operational details you hear little about, but there's a very good oversight on this. The Nuclear Regulatory Commission also does a bang-up job in licensing. They have people at each of the sites overseeing the plants, and that provides sort of on-the-spot oversight. They're technically sound people, so they know exactly what's going on. And I think it provides us a...
That's okay.
Excuse me.
That's okay.
Provides us a good comfort zone, I think, that the public can utilize in not being maybe as cautious as you're suggesting, or as the companies being as irresponsible as getting away with things.
We talked in the first part of the program, mentioned the fact that here in the United States, 20% of our electricity comes from nuclear generation, and the fact that there are other countries where the percentage is much greater. You gave, for example, Japan, where they're entirely imported on. They don't have any oil, so any oil they have to import. France, where they're generating more than 70% of their electricity of nuclear power. It's my understanding, and do correct me if I'm wrong, that though in other countries, they also don't really have a good strategy yet for dealing with high-level waste either. There's certainly nobody in any other country, I think, has built anything like Yucca Mountain or some kind of a permanent or at least very long-term storage facility. Now, I don't know, what are other countries doing with that waste?
They're separating out the very long-lived ones and storing those, and at this stage, I'd say temporarily storing them. They're putting some of the plutonium back in, or at least gearing up to do that with the mixed oxide fuels, and so that will take care of the plutonium stream in the long run. The uranium-235 can be recovered and put back in. And if we go to breeding, the uranium-238, which is the abundant isotope in natural uranium, would be the potential resource.
So it sounds as if essentially they are doing what you suggest that we should do or could do.
Yes, but they're not running breeders. France did develop two breeders, Phoenix and Super Phoenix. It's a big job for one country to develop a program like that. Mm-hmm. And I think they just ran out of the capacity to be able to do it. It was a major step forward. Most of those require long periods of time when you make big jumps in design, and they never quite made it conceptually and technically. Was okay, mm-hmm. but they had this growth of size problem with it.
Well, let's talk with some other people that were listening. Someone here in Champaign-Urbana, line number one. Hello.
Hi. I was wondering if you could explain a little bit more on half-lives, why the stuff decays at a faster rate for a while and then slower. I'm comparing it to if I put a pail of water out, it all evaporates at the same rate. Why does radioactive material go in half-lives? And I'll hang up and listen. Thank you.
Okay.
That's a good question, and I wasn't very explicit, and I should have provided that to the audience. Each isotope has its own half-life. It doesn't change. So once it becomes radioactive, a mass of material, it will decay at a given rate. And that means that we speak of a half-life, so when half of it is decayed, that's the half-life period. So if it's got a half-life of 30 years for cesium, then we'd have half the amount of cesium 30 years from now. All of them have their own signature on that. So it clearly isn't something that changes over time in the mix. The amounts of material left will change because some will decay off, others are decaying more slowly.
Here, now, I guess initially the way I was thinking about it was you think about it, a substance in terms of its radioactivity, that say, if you have something and you say that its half-life is 100 years, is it correct to say that then in 100 years it will only be half as radioactive, or that that's not exactly right, that it's decaying, but what it may decay into is products that are also radioactive?
Potentially. Some schemes where they decay, there's a mother-daughter sequence mm-hmm. that goes into. And typically, the half-life decay of the daughters, and I'm not sure this is universal, tends to be a little faster. But not necessarily. Mm-hmm. We have this occurring in reactor operation, actually. Inside the reactor, xenon is a fission product. And if xenon has a certain affinity for neutrons, and the subsequent isotope of xenon that it has decayed to has a different absorption of neutrons, that will affect how we operate the plants. But typically these end up to be hours and tens of hours long. And so it's an operational detail, not a waste storage detail.
Mm-hmm. Is it possible to explain in ways that people who are not physicists will get, though, why it is that when you look at the decay rate, it's not a steady curve. It just doesn't go. It's not like if you had a pail of water that it would evaporate that way. That it's this thing where you get half gone, and then you get half of that gone, and then you get half of that gone. That it goes down in this kind of stair step fashion.
Right. Well, it's continuous. And it turns out that the amount of material you have, if you start out with a certain mass of radioactive material, mm-hmm. it will decay, and that's an exponential.
Okay.
And that exponential, of course, never goes to zero. It just gets smaller and smaller and smaller. It's like mm-hmm. if I go half the distance somewhere, then I go half the distance again. I never get there.
Right. Okay. Well, I hope that it partly at least answers the question of the caller. Let's go on and talk with, we have some other folks here. Someone next in Urbana, and this is line number two. Hello.
Hi. Yeah. My question is, if nuclear power is so safe, why did the government and the nuclear industry make it illegal for me to sue any profits of the nuclear power industry if there's an accident? Thanks, and I'll take my answer off the air or off the phone.
All right.
Well, it's not too surprising, I guess, that some of the there are some constraints put on. I'm not sure that I necessarily agree that the suing isn't possible, but there is a consortium of insurance that the government backs with these very, very large investments and potential suits that could arrive from an accident. So as a result, there is a protection there in the system. The idea that nuclear is somehow or other covered better than other areas. May very well be true, but the Price-Anderson Act went in very early in this whole nuclear, commercial nuclear side, and was put in basically to support and provide backup to an industry that has, in the eyes of the public and maybe in the eyes of the legal system, some potential for catastrophic accidents. Mm. And we've seen some of these. Three Mile Island, I'm sure you as a caller would say was a catastrophic accident. Yet the amount of radiation that got into the atmosphere from that particular incident in Pennsylvania was very small and basically not traceable. It was the radioactive fission gases, fission products that are in gaseous form that got released when the fuel cladding failed, the cladding around the fuel, sort of tin can around the fuel, when that failed, and there was a release of vapor steam from the main plant into the containment dome, which is another protective layer, and that released to the atmosphere because of a drain that didn't have a stop condition in it. But it was gas that just dispersed in the atmosphere and basically had no impact. It would be warm and therefore just rise like any hot gas in the atmosphere and disappear.
I guess the question gets at one of those complaints that some people have about the industry, and that is that it doesn't really have to stand on its own because the government has come along and said that in any potential liability that you encounter, we will back you. In a sense, we will pay part of the cost that you would have to bear completely on your own. And I think that some people might make the argument that would be inappropriate for a fledgling industry. But by this time, that nuclear power shouldn't need that kind of help from the government anymore.
But this Price-Anderson Act, the companies pay into it. That's, they're the ones that are building up the base for that whole situation. The government basically has established cap. So we're going around now establishing caps on liability, medical being the one that I think has happened in Illinois just recently.
Mm-hmm.
So it isn't unheard of in other industries. And I'm probably not the best person to be responding to that. There are other people who follow that. I'm not quite down that same track on the legal side of it.
Okay. Well, let's talk some other people. Let's go to Urbana again, line three. Hello. Is our caller there, line three? No? Okay. Let's go to Charleston then, line number four. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
Yeah, I was active in the nuclear power industry with a supplier, Babcock & Wilcox, in the early 70s. And my impression is, having sort of halfway followed it since that time, is that the technology of a boiling water reactor and pressurized water reactor nuclear power plants is basically, 40-some years old, 40 to 50 years old. Haven't there been some new designs of reactors that are supposedly intrinsically safe, i.e., if something goes wrong, the darn thing just shuts down?
Well, yes, and that is the situation with respect to virtually the two types that you suggested. There are fail-safe conditions in the operation, so that had, for instance, Three Mile Island, which was a B&W plant, allowed the safety systems to fully go into effect and not be interrupted, it would not have resulted in the continuous degradation of that facility.
Well, haven't there been some new designs since that time that are even more intrinsically safe?
Yes, there are. And these have been licensed, but we haven't been building plants. So is the AP600, which was a Westinghouse design, now an AP1000, the 600 and 1000 referring to the capacity of the plant in kilowatt, in megawatt capacity. Those, yes, have built in further safeguards so that they're basically walk away from them and allow the safety systems in the plant to take care of the malfunction and the excursion, whatever the accident turned out to be, whether it's a large break in the system so you lose pressure and you have to add water and this sort of thing to it. Those are automatically built in.
What about the ones that the French and the Japanese have been building since the 70s?
They're basically the same designs we're dealing with.
Okay.
The French have their own design, but it's PWR. All of those are pressurized water reactors, same as we use in the Navy.
Mm-hmm.
The Japanese have both types, predominantly boiling water reactors. The Koreans have designed and built a pressurized water reactor on their own. China's building plants now with the Western technology, and they're going wholesale forward. They have much larger pollution problems than we do, so
yeah.
They're anxious to get them in place.
Thank you very much.
All right, thank you. We have about 10 minutes left in this part of Focus 580. I would like to just introduce the guest once again, Barkla Jones. He's professor of nuclear plasma and radiological engineering at University of Illinois. We're talking about nuclear power. Questions are welcome. 333-9455, toll free, 800-222-9455. Back again to another caller here. This is Champagne and line one. Hello.
Hi, yes. Good morning. I'm concerned about the kind of cavalier talk about the end result of all of this, and I'm especially what I've been reading about for the past 15 years in depleted uranium being used in warheads and artillery shells and things like that for our war-making machines. Now, where does that come from? Who's using it? And how can we guarantee that those depleted uranium isn't killing off our generations wherever they are, whether it's with the indigenous people in Iraq or our soldiers that we're sending in Iraq or Afghanistan or wherever they happen to be using these depleted uranium weapons?
Well, the use of depleted uranium is simply it's a very heavy element. And so as a result, if you make a shell out of that material, it will have
weapons. You're talking about artillery shells.
Artillery or for that anti-tank, that
right.
sort of thing.
Right.
It will have much more capacity to penetrate thick steel vessels, tanks.
I understand that, but what about the result of that explosion, getting the depleted uranium, however far down it is in its half-life?
Well, the depleted uranium is natural. Where that has come from is from our weapons programs where we were enriching uranium, and actually we're enriching uranium to support the nuclear power industry because we need excess uranium-235. Not the uranium-238, which is the dominant amount in the depleted uranium isotope. So as a result, it has all its natural properties. It does give off some alpha, which has no penetrating capability.
What if you breathe it in?
Pardon?
What if you breathe it in?
Yes. Now, I was just going to say that if you inhale that material, and alpha can certainly do damage because a piece of paper will stop the alpha particle, but your lungs are vulnerable, that type of thing. But so as a result, yes, there is some side effect there. I'm not an expert in the area. I just understand why they're using it as a material for a particular purpose, and yes, it has some side effects.
Well, is it is it, can it, if it's used in a large scale, which is we understand it's being used in the current wars in Afghanistan and especially Iraq, that there's a certain liability that the United States will have toward people, whether they are sent there from here or who are indigenous living there and who are affected by this, and it causes damage to cells and to reproductive systems and all sorts of things. Does that liability that the government has placed over nuclear power plants, is that part of why you can't sue the government if you are affected, or your reproductive system is affected, or if there's a huge amount of cancers from people returning from the war zone?
Well, I'm clearly not the expert in this area.
Okay. And what I'm really concerned about here is the cavalier attitude of people in the industry who find this so fascinating and so wonderful. And from my point of view, we're passing our problem of today, which is the material that's left over from all of this wonderful ability to generate electricity onto our children, our grandchildren, and generations to come.
I'm not sure that I necessarily agree that the nuclear industry is cavalier. This is not part of the nuclear industry. The increasing of uranium selection of 235 isotope to put in reactor fuels is just a necessary part of the fuel cycle. This is done by the government, and they handle all of the uranium in the system. And so as a result, it's not something that the nuclear power industry really has any thing to do with.
It's a I'm not saying that it's not an appropriate thing to be talking about, but it's a very different issue from that we're talking about here this morning. Not that it has no connection, but it's rather maybe is something we should say should be the subject for another program, and we could find other guests to do it. Let's go on here, do at least one more caller, and going to, I believe, Urbana in line two. Hello.
Hi. Mm-hmm. I have a clarification about the difference between the evaporation rates of water in a bucket and decay rates of radionuclides. If you imagine taking a pile of coins and throwing them into the air, when they land, take away all the heads. If you do that to the remaining coins every few minutes, say, then your pile of coins gets smaller by a half for every few minutes that you're doing this. The evaporation of water out of a bucket is really quite similar, except that you take pursue the same analogy. You take a bucket of coins, and every time interval you take only the coins on the surface, flip those, take away the heads. But then you've got a whole other same surface area. So the next time you do the coin flipping, you start with the same number of coins. So the rate of loss from the bucket of water is constant until you get right down to the bottom of the bucket. So that's the difference between the two. They're both random processes where some system has to exceed an energy threshold in order for a particle to be removed from it. So there you have it. I hope that's a useful explanation.
Well, let me add just a point to it. When you're doing the bucket of water, you're dealing with a surface area.
That's right.
Which is only part of the whole bucket.
That's right.
When you're dealing with radioactivity, it's in the whole volume.
That's right.
So that you'd be evaporating from everywhere in the bucket.
That's right.
So it's an entirely different process. And your evaporation with water is going to be dependent on the atmospheric conditions.
That's right.
Which doesn't change for radioactivity.
That's right.
Okay. Well, thanks for the explanation. I think I understand that. I'll have to think about that for a while.
Okay.
We've got one more caller. We'll try to get him here, and I believe this is line three in Urbana.
Yes. I was wondering, maybe I missed it because it was called away a few times, but is anything being done with the fusion project?
Yes. Quite a bit is being done with the fusion process. There's some cold fusion that just got some legs recently. Not that it's going to be producing power anytime soon. But the International Thermonuclear Reactor Experiment is alive and well. It's international. It's Europe and Japan and the United States and Russia. We're probably a long way from being able to harness it, but it's alive and well. And sometime, probably not in my lifetime, fusion can become another valuable source for humanity.
All right. Well, we're going to have to leave it at there. Perhaps that's also something we can talk about on another show. But for the moment, we'll have to stop, at least for this hour of Focus 580. And I do want to mention again that this summer, we're interested in doing some programs looking at energy policy, sources of energy. And if you have thoughts about what you'd like us to do, suggestions for guests or topics, we're certainly happy to have them. You can call us, drop us a line, send us an email, and we'll see what we could do. We also want to say thanks to our guest for this hour, Barclay Jones. He's professor of nuclear plasma and radiological engineering at University of Illinois. Thank you.
You're welcome.
The broadcast today made possible in part by a grant from Horines Pianos Plus, your Steinway Piano Showroom in Bloomington. Horines Pianos Plus offers new and pre-owned pianos by Steinway & Sons, Boston by Steinway, and other fine pianos. Coming up a little bit later today on the Afternoon Magazine, we will peer into Western history prior to the Industrial Revolution, a time when the night was illuminated by firelight and moonlight. Our guest for the program is historian Roger Eakerch. He's the author of a newly published book titled At Day's Close, Night in Times Past, and he will be talking with Celeste Quinn in the 1 o'clock hour of the Afternoon Magazine today. The show itself gets underway at noon here on AM 580. Coming up in the next hour of this show, we will be talking with Marcy Hamilton. She is a constitutional law scholar. Her particular area of expertise, the relationship between church and state. She teaches at the Benjamin Cardozo School of Law in New York City, and we'll be talking about some of the issues in her recent book, God versus the Gavel, in which he makes the argument that increasingly in recent years, people in some religious organizations have made the argument that they're not bound by or shouldn't be bound by the same laws that cover everybody else. We'll talk about that in a little bit. We'll also have news from National Public Radio. First, though, an update on the markets.
And currently on the Chicago Board of Trade, the wheat futures are holding firm on higher than expected export sales right now. The July contract unchanged at 313 and a quarter. September at